1-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Hi there, this is James from the Stock Club podcast. Before we start today's episode, I just wanted to let you know about an exclusive offer we're running here at My Wall Street for listeners of the Stock Club podcast. For a limited time only, brand new users of the My Wall Street app can get an extended 30-day free trial, four times longer than our standard trial. That means that you can access our full list of more than 100 stock picks, our stock of the month selections that have smashed the market's returns, and all of the rest of our investing content for free for 30 days. To avail of this offer, simply download the My Wall Street app using the link in the notes for today's show. Don't miss this great opportunity to get a head start in your investing life. Hi there and welcome to the Stock Club podcast, coming to you from the top floor of my Wall Street HQ here in Dublin, Ireland. I'm James, and with me this week is my Wall Street co-founder and chief investor, Emmett Savage, and our head analyst, Rory Caron. Today, we're talking about Peloton's upcoming IPO, Ulta Beauty's 30% drop last week, and the two companies that surprised us most with their success. So in the last episode, Rory, we were talking about WeWork and their upcoming IPO. This week, we're going to talk about another company fighting for IPO soon.
Yeah, it's a company called Peloton.
Yep.
Which, you know, we talked last week about how mad and
shady.
I wouldn't say shady, but just like very kind of fuzzy, wuzzy kind of language was used in WeWork's S1.
So, what's the difference between shady and fuzzy wuzzy?
It's just kind of like, kind of, who's that woman who's running for president who was like Oprah's guru? Marianne Williamson or something.
Oh, yeah,
is that
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
The way she talks about like love and energy and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I find that creeping into a lot of S1s recently. You know, people, they're not talking about, they don't want to talk about the numbers, they want to talk about how they make people feel.
Yeah, a bit airy fairy.
Yeah, so you can see that a little bit on Peloton's S1 as well.
Is it as bad as WeWorks?
No, it's not as bad as WeWorks at all. Actually, I was actually impressed by the S1. We'll get to that in the end, but one of the first lines they say is, "We sell happiness." I know. Oh. So they just get into that. They get in quite right away. They're not as bad as WeWork, who are like literally going to change the world and cure cancer and end poverty and, you know, that kind of thing. Mm. But Peloton, in case anyone doesn't know, is an exercise equipment company. The main kind of idea is they sell you an exercise bike as their main product for about $2,000. And it's got a screen attached. And then you pay a subscription of $40 a month to watch live exercise classes, and they'll kind of, and you can compete against people, and you can get kind of your metrics worked out and stuff like that, your performance measured and things like that. So when I first heard the idea, I thought, that's crackers. Sounds like an exercise bike with an iPad glued onto it.
Yeah.
But actually, the business is operating quite well. They're looking to raise about $500 million in this IPO. And the last time they were privately valued, which is just about a year ago, they were valued just over $4 billion. Their revenue has grown incredibly fast. Last June, they reported revenue for the year of $915 million, which is a 110% increase on last year's revenue, which itself was a 100% increase on the year before revenue. So revenue's up fourfold in 2 years. Losses have also grown.
Yeah.
They're not profitable, as just like every company that's IPOing this year. They lost about $240 million last year. Now, in fairness to them, a lot of that was them buying back stock from employees as part of a secondary offering. But the sale of bikes, if you look at the S1, the sale of the bikes is pretty much making up for the cost to acquire a customer. And that means that their subscriptions will pretty much fall straight to the bottom line once they make a certain scale. So if you'd removed R&D and G&A from the equation last year, the company would have been profitable. And the G&A figure was highly inflated by that secondary offering, which I mentioned. They claim they have a 12-month retention rate of 95%. They also believe they have a very serviceable, addressable market, about 14 million people in the US, UK, Germany and Canada, which are the only markets they're available in right now. And they currently have about 500,000 active subscriptions. So, you know, they haven't penetrated, they're about 4% penetration of what they think is a serviceable addressable market, which is people that could afford the bike, would be interested in the product, and that they think they could get eventually.
Yeah. So is it better than the Bowflex?
Yeah,
Nautilus, I mean, part two.
I think they could have something to do with what was the insane decline of Nautilus. Yeah. But if I mean, like, a lot of the, I think, criticism of this company is that it's very expensive.
Yeah, and it's very geared towards a very affluent market.
Well, in their marketing, certainly it is geared towards an affluent market. There's a great Twitter thread of screenshots of their advertisements, which is people setting up their Peloton bike in like the fanciest conservatory you've ever seen, look over or overlooking kind of New York City from the penthouse.
Yeah.
But actually, I've done a little bit of calculation, and it's not actually expensive at all.
Really?
No. It's if they sell you a Peloton bike, which at the moment is $2,245, which includes delivery and setup. They're also offering, by the way, 39-month financing at 0% APR, just in the US. So that would make monthly installments of $58.
Yeah.
You add on the subscription, which is $39, so you got $97 per month. The average subscriber, according to them, does 11.5 workouts per month. So that boils down to $8.40 for every workout.
Okay.
Now, if you look at something like SoulCycle, they're charging $35 per workout, which is a competitor, which is just basically a spinning class in a gym.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you want to do workouts, this is a really, really cheap option, like on a monthly basis. Now, do you get a better workout in your own home than you do in a gym? Is probably not, because it's probably a kind of motivating factor of being surrounded by other sweaty people.
Yeah.
But at the same time, with that massive subscriber base, they can amateurize costs and get like the best instructors out there. So there's a kind of give and take there.
So I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan of the product, and I think that $2,000 is the ballpark. And my family and I went out shopping for a treadmill for our home about a year and a half ago, and that was the price point.
Do Peloton sell treadmills as well?
They do. It's a newer product, and it costs more. It costs about twice as much.
Right.
So I don't know what the reason for that is. I suppose treadmills have to kind of go up and down.
Don't it might be more engineering. But for me, that is the kind of ballpark of what you'd expect. And products that take away customer pain are kind of geared to succeed, no pun intended. And we have in Peloton a product that allows people to work out, you know, from their home, obviously enough. No trip to and from the gym required. No kind of having to dress in the latest gear to look good in the gym or worrying what anyone else thinks. And I think all those collectively, along with the classes that you described, I think make for a very compelling proposition.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're digitizing your time. You know, if you don't have to worry about when you're getting to class or getting to the gym or getting changed and all that kind of stuff, that's a huge benefit for people. It really removes the friction.
Yeah.
And just on the on a margin side, they have incredible margins on the hardware. So they're making 45% gross margins on those bikes, which if you compare it to Apple, which is the king of tech hardware margins, they only make 30%.
Wow.
Now, the subscription margins aren't at the levels you would expect from a pure SaaS play, but I mean, they're spending a lot of money getting the final product better, so that they will grow with scale.
Yeah.
So
speaking of the bikes then, so if you sign up for Peloton and you do your 12 months and then you decide it's not for you, what do you do with that bike or treadmill?
I'm glad you asked, because I checked around and they do have a very high resale value.
Okay.
So, you know, which is strange for exercise equipment, but I suppose the high cost would lead people to go out and look for any kind of discount they can.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's bikes that are selling for only a couple of hundred quid less than the original price.
So it's easy enough to shift them.
Yeah, so it's, I mean, like, it's, it, you know, you're not stuck with it if you decide you don't want to do it. And I suppose as well, the high cost will probably motivate you a bit more to use it.
That's what I was going to say. I'd say that contributes towards the retention rate a little bit.
Yeah, totally.
you want to justify that big outlay for at least 12 months or something.
Yeah, I think so.
Cool. So that's Peloton. So on the shortlist or?
It's on the shortlist. We'll see what it floats at.
Yeah.
That would be a big thing because, you know, if at 4 billion, it looks very attractive. If it gets into the 10 billion mark,
it does it beyond.
Completely agree, yeah.
Yeah, we'll have to.
Based on the 500 million number you just gave us there, I was thinking, anything around 3.5 to 4.5 billion would be interesting.
Very interesting.
Speaking of valuations, I actually forgot to mention at the start of the podcast, we all went for our first Beyond Meat burger last week. What were our thoughts?
I was very impressed with it.
Yeah, I was very impressed.
It was a very, very close match.
Yeah, like it tasted better than a lot of we had it in a chain that I wouldn't normally be a massive fan of. In terms of the quality, but I thought it was better than any of the beef burgers I've ever had there. The only thing that the first thing you notice is it's the patties are so uniform. That makes them look very processed, and that would kind of turn me. If I saw that in a normal restaurant, that would be a big turnoff for me. Because I like kind of fresh ingredients, and I like to know that it's like been made in the kitchen, all that kind of stuff. So even though I was really impressed by it, and I thought the taste was excellent, it's probably I'll probably never order one again, because when I go out and want to get a burger, I want to feel the get the fresh taste of what that restaurant is offering. Whereas this is going to taste the exact same every go.
Yeah, that's a good fair point, but I think it would push people maybe around the fence towards, you know, vegetarianism or even veganism. I think it could push them over with being a viable alternative.
Yeah, it'd be interesting on checking out the mince, because I make a lot of stuff with mince meat at home, and if you can make chili con carne or spaghetti bolognese with that, that would be huge.
Yeah, we had a debate in our home that night and about the Beyond Meat burger, and certainly... I had the same concerns as Rory. When you kind of look closely, you can see its uniformity is disconcerting. But I didn't especially like the aroma. I thought the taste was spot on. And I think the four of us agreed that had we not been told that it was a pea protein and brown rice patty, that we would have thought it was meat.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, you could 100%. Have easily been fooled.
I don't know if it was just real or imagined, but I felt fuller for longer after it. So I don't know about its glycemic loading, but certainly it filled me up.
Yeah.
I thought it was delicious. And whenever it's an option, unlike you, Rory, I'd probably go for it because I'd like to reduce the amount of meat.
I mean, I do it at home. Yeah, for sure. But when I'm out, like when I go to a restaurant, I'm like, I'm out there for a meal that I want to taste something kind of different, whatever the restaurant's offering that's better than the other burger places around.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
if I know I'm getting something that's going to taste exactly like the one I've already had, I'm probably going to pass on it.
The minced meat, I agree with you. There's more latitude for flavour variants, I guess. Yeah.
Moving on then, Emmett, what's going on with Ulta Beauty these days?
Ulta Beauty. Ulta Beauty, I'll describe what the business does first, I guess, just to remind our listeners. Ulta Beauty is a beauty salon or a chain of beauty salons across the US. It has, on last count, circa 1,200 locations in 50 states, and 90% are off-mall. They have a whole bunch of products. I mean, anything you can imagine related to personal care and beauty, Ulta sell, and their services are everything from hair, skin, brow, makeup, that kind of thing. When you look at the business and its growth over the last few years, from 2014 to 2018 inclusive, it's been like the stairs in your home with respect to sales. Sales has steadily increased every year from 2014 to 2018, and earnings per share has also increased in a very predictable upward cycle. So Ulta Salon has been tremendously successful over the 5+ years that were up until now. And they, at the moment, have about 7% share of the $90 billion beauty products market. So Ulta Salon, I think to most listeners in the US, and I'd hazard say most female listeners in the US, is a known brand. So last Thursday night, the stock market closed, as it does, at which point Ulta Beauty was about 338 bucks per share. The CEO and her team sat down and spoke into a microphone about Q2, and the next morning the stock opened and shares were down almost 30%, 27%, to about 248 bucks a share. Now, not to the question you asked, James, but the first non-related point, I think, is worth making is this is a wonderful example of why we don't like out-of-hours trades.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, retail, as retail investors, you know, we should only buy when the market is open, and things like this happen too often for someone who wants to beat the market. So the top line don't read is out-of-hours trades are not good, and Ulta Salon demonstrated that between market close and open last Thursday and Friday night and morning. So what happened? Well, firstly, Ulta did well, but not as well as analysts had targeted. And the second thing was CEO Mary Dillon spoke about headwinds in 2019, which is the polite society way of saying that the year ahead will not be what was originally intended. So if I can just kind of go deeper on those two headlines. Yep. So looking at the actuals versus analyst expectations, revenue was up 12%, which is pretty good, to about $1.67 billion on the quarter. Analysts had targeted $1.75 billion. So they brought in 1.67, analysts expected 1.75 billion. Secondly, on the same heading of actuals versus analyst expectations, earnings per share increased by 12.2%, which again is very respectable. It's a great number, and increased to about $2.76 per share. And analysts had targeted $2.80 per share. So the first, I suppose, problem, if you like, was that the company missed what analysts had predicted on average.
Okay.
The second, I guess, is what did Mary Dillon and her team say? And these headwinds I mentioned, it's the truth, or at least the greater insight is more about where the CEO and their team see the business going.
Yeah.
So earnings per share are only expected to grow this year between 4 and 6% compared to the last guidance they gave of between 6 and 7%. And the full year EPS forecast range was cut by nearly a dollar. So from around $13 per share to about $12 per share. And the CFO, Scott Stetterson, explained that the company had anticipated an improving trend in prestige makeup and strong growth in the overall market that had not materialized. And so the sky fell down and the company saw an $8 billion drop in its market cap while we rested our heads in bed.
Yeah.
Now, in the quarter that was Q2, the company opened another 20 stores. Its gross margins improved. And on the whole, when I looked at what happened, I believe the market overreacted. You could also say that the market readjusted to say that this is no longer a growth story, which I think is probably true.
Yeah.
But another truth is that beauty salons, whether a simple barber shop on the corner of your street or a giant brand like Ulta Salon, they provide a service that cannot go into the cloud. Now, they might sell products that can be bought online, but when you go to get your hair fixed or made up or your eyebrows, you know, HD'd or whatever, you got to go to a person, and Ulta Salon are dominant in the area. And usually I'm very skeptical of when a CEO says that they're confident about long-term growth immediately after announcing unfavorable news. But in this instance, I think Ulta is at a price that will beat the S&P 500 from today over the 5+ years ahead. So when Mary Dillon said that she was confident in the long-term growth prospects, certainly in light of the 27, what is now 30% drop since last Thursday's price, I tend to agree. And that's, you know, is a business Amazon proof? And while nothing is supremely Amazon proof, I think Ulta is in a really good position. And I didn't like that the arrow has fallen somewhat, but they're continuing to open stores, which isn't necessarily a good thing, but they're doing it based on some of the best management, one of the best management teams in America. They have an awesome customer loyalty program. And I'm very interested in the stock right now.
Yeah.
It's funny though that even with the 30% drop, I mean, they're still above where they were in January.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems very extreme.
It does, yeah.
But then they'd had a very good last quarter and possibly this was a kind of
A readjustment
from what might have been the stock heating up a little too much. I thought the earnings call was very interesting. She, Mary Dillon, clearly indicating that this was a macro event, not necessarily poor execution on their part.
Yeah.
That just the makeup and cosmetics market has really softened in 2019. And I actually think she noted a kind of lack of innovation within the industry. Said, I'll just read a little quote here. "We've seen strong growth in cosmetics driven by new rituals and application techniques like contouring and brow styling and innovative new product formats like liquid lip, palettes and minis. This innovation resulted in new makeup routines requiring new products, which drove strong incremental growth." And apparently that's just not happening at the moment.
So there's no hot trend right now.
There's not a hot trend going on. Yeah. I mean, there was some stuff in the earnings call that I thought was very positive. You know, they've got a new exclusive deal with Kim Kardashian, who has, you know, 150 million Instagram followers. There's a new range coming out by Millie Bobby Brown from Stranger Things, who's quite popular as well, a kind of up-and-coming influencer, perhaps. Yeah. I suppose the big question is this a signal that there is a trend of people spending less money on cosmetics overall, perhaps embracing kind of a more natural look going forward?
Yeah. I think she mentioned something like that in her statements too, that there was a kind of a trend towards skincare rather than cosmetics.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's jokes going around Dublin all the time that younger people are wearing far too much of it, and there's bad names being said about them, and or jokes being made about on their expense. I haven't seen any sign that that's dying down personally.
No,
perhaps there is a movement there that we're seeing in the numbers.
Yeah, well, it's I don't know, maybe these are false correlations, but there's a wider kind of shift. We were talking about Beyond Meat earlier, shift from kind of more social conscience, and I don't know if cosmetics fall into that necessarily, but I remember we talked once before about brands as well in clothing, how people are kind of moving away from branded clothing towards more generic clothing.
So yeah, that's right. It's the anti-brand. The $87 billion beauty products market that I mentioned earlier, on, if you go to Ulta's investor relations website by just Googling Ulta IR, on the very front page of it, you'll see a very nice kind of 17-page presentation on their business and the overall market. And what I find interesting was the how giant the market opportunity remains. And the 87 billion market, 15% of that 87 billion is hair care, 23% is skin, and 20% is cosmetics. So over half of the addressable market comes from hair, skin and cosmetics, and then it has a longer tail on fragrance and bathware and other things. But they are positioned to capitalize on whatever is hot at the moment.
Yeah.
And I tend to listen and accept as the truth when they say a headwind was no hot trend, to paraphrase Mary Dillon, because it's kind of true. Even here in the streets of Dublin, we would be, I suppose, laggards when you look at certain products. Like if we go back to Peloton.
Or even trends.
Trends, full stop. Like Peloton's, just sorry to loop back, now has adverts on TV here in Ireland. And that is a sign to me of pure globalization. And when we look at the streets to Ulta Salon, HD eyebrows were a thing in Ireland about a year ago. And certainly I haven't heard or seen or observed any hot trend at this moment. So to me, what Mary Dillon said was absolutely the truth. Mm. And we might find in 3 months' time there's a new hot trend, and that could be a tailwind for Ulta Salon. But certainly in the big picture, I still love how they're positioned. And I love how beauty is synonymous with going to, or kind of hair care is synonymous with going to somebody to do it for you.
Yeah, it's very experiential.
It is experiential. Yeah. It's more than just how you look. It's how you feel in the moment and from the moment you walk in the doors to out the doors again.
I think as well, I mean, if there is a shift in what people are buying, I would trust that management team to pivot in the right direction.
I was going to say, we're big fans of Mary Dillon here. Yeah. You've spoken about her before.
Yeah. Is she still on the board of Starbucks?
She is, of course.
She is, yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So that's we're not too concerned about Ulta then.
No.
Yeah. I think it's a buy.
So do I. Yeah, so do I.
Bold statement. So moving on then. So just here's some of the more recent things in the My Wall Street app at the moment. We're at the start of a new month, so that means there's loads of great things to check out, including September's Stock of the Month, which went live this week. We also have a brand new stock joining our market beating list on Monday. Rory, do you want to give a clue? One of your famous cryptic clues?
No.
Helpful.
you didn't tell me. I had to, like, I'd come up with something interesting if you gave me some sort of
I like
cue.
You, I like catching on top.
Have you picked it?
Yes. Do you know what it is?
I know what it is. It's just not. I haven't got a clever thing to say about it right now.
I also want to remind you that we've our very first seminar event coming up in person. This is your opportunity to meet Emmett and the rest of my Wall Street analyst team and absorb more than 25 years of investing experience in just one day. For more information about In Person, please visit inperson.mywallstreet.com. That's inperson.mywallstreet.com. And finally, don't forget about the extended free trial we're offering to listeners of the Stock Club podcast. If you've never used My Wall Street app before and want to avail of a 30-day free trial, just follow the link in the notes for today's show. Right, jargon busters. So we got a few questions in this month. Emmett, I'm going to come to you first. So Stephen wrote into us and asked, what is a W8BENE form and why do I need it for investing?
Okay, so the W8BEN form is a piece of paper used by non-resident aliens earning income from the from US sources. So why does owning stock qualify as earning income? Because a lot of stocks pay dividends. But we need to pause. What is an alien? An alien primarily refers to extraterrestrial life, which does not originate from Earth. That is the Oxford Dictionary of an alien. But in this context, it means somebody born in Dublin or Edinburgh or Paris or Sydney or anywhere outside of the 50 states of America. So we three are aliens, which I think most of our listeners have concluded by now anyway. The W8BEN's purpose is mainly to let a broker know that the person in question is not subject to the usual tax withholding from investment income. So it's a form you fill out to tell your broker in the US that you're not American.
Okay.
American citizens and resident aliens do not need to use the W-8 form. They use the imaginatively named W-9 form, and that certifies their tax identification number. And I don't know what they did with W-1 all the way up to W-7, but when you get to 8, you're an alien, and when you get to 9, you're an American citizen. So so the W-8BEN is a piece of, digital paper that you fill in once a year. I think it's once a year. You fill it in when your broker asks you. It's a very, very simple form. It's a one-pager. Back in the day, you'd fill it out with a pen. You can do it now thanks to DocuSign and similar services. In a jiffy, and you just have to do it. And a failure to provide it will result in awful things, most especially 30% tax withholding and penalties. So the bottom line is you don't need to fear it. It's a very simple form. It's legally mandated. Your broker will ask you for it when they need it.
For non-US citizens.
For non-US citizens, for aliens.
Right. So next question then. Rory, what do we think about low-cost brokers and will they ever affect the market?
What do we think about them? They have certainly democratized investing for a lot more people than was available beforehand.
Yeah.
You know, 20 years ago, it was probably not 20 years. You were investing 20 years ago.
Yeah.
They didn't have the kind of crazy minimums or whatever, did they? It was.
They did. I mean, my first online brokerage account was Datech 25 years ago. Yeah. And they had a minimum, yeah.
Yeah, but they used to have, it used to be kind of outside the realm of the average.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was several $1,000.
Yeah. And, you know, crazy fees that just were, you know, unpalatable to most people. And so people tended to stay away from the stock market or do it purely through their pension fund. Discount brokers low-cost brokers, as the questionnaire has asked, they have just made it very simple for people to invest in stocks. They charge minimum commissions. If even any commissions.
Yeah.
You know, you've got certain companies charging zero commissions. And it just opens up investing to an awful lot more people. Now, the thing to remember is that the old brokers that used to provide a lot more services, a lot more of an holistic service than discount brokers do.
Yeah.
So discount brokers, for example, are not a fiduciary. They are not responsible for giving you advice on how to manage your money in any way. So if you go to they are execution only, as we say.
Okay.
So if you go in there with and want to buy 1,000 shares of a very volatile share that will take up all the money in your portfolio, your discount broker's not going to say, that's not a good idea.
Yeah, okay.
They're just
going to
do it.
So they don't give the guidance as such. Yeah.
No. It's a utilitarian service. Like if you take it there's an analogy between a broker and what My Wall Street does. And the analogy, it's like, for example, a drugstore and a doctor. Mm. And a drugstore, if you walk in with a prescription, hands you whatever it says.
Yeah.
It doesn't debate. It doesn't ask you how you're feeling. It gives you what it basically is told to give you. And that's exactly the role of a broker.
Yeah.
They fulfill an order based on your desires, requirements, or whatever. And that's the end of it. There is no opinion. And My Wall Street, we have positioned our business as I see, like the doctor, where it's the wisdom,
yeah,
where we are applying intelligence to the 10,000 listed vehicles, and that's the area of the world we sit in.
Okay, interesting.
Another thing to just be careful of is that discount brokers, I'm not going to name any names here, but certain ones I have seen kind of heavily promoting things like classes and or tutorials and options or
yeah.
tutorials and other derivative products, which, you know, their bottom line is helped by you participating in more expensive trades. So it's a little bit kind of shady in that sense, some of them. So just, you know, be aware when you're using a discount broker of exactly what your fees are. And, I mean, we always just say buy common equity and buy
go
for the long term. The second part of the question, will they affect the market?
Yeah.
That's a probably philosophical question that I'm not sure I could kind of foresee. I'll do some more research onto that and maybe come back next podcast. I haven't read anywhere any kind of concerns about what impact it'll have on the overall market or what would happen in a downturn based on low cost brokers.
Cool. And then the final question we have is from longtime listener Wendy, and she wants to know, how do we evaluate restaurant stocks? Emma, I might start with you. I know you're a large shareholder in Chipotle.
I am. Actually, it's been, to my own surprise, a remarkable winner. I nearly lost faith in the business post E. coli. Yeah. But anyway, yes, I've owned very many restaurant stocks over the years, and the US stock markets, that is the NASDAQ and notably the New York Stock Exchange, have had a fair share of restaurants listed in them. Not to Wendy's point, but each country's stock market is to a point an autobiography of that country's history.
Yeah.
And if you looked at the London Stock Exchange, if you looked at the Dublin Irish Stock Exchange, now called Euronext, or if you looked at the New York Stock Exchange, and the makeup of the businesses listed on those exchanges tells the story of local commerce. And in America, fast casual and slow casual and every other type of dining has been very much part of the biography of America. So we have seen so many restaurant stocks listed over the years, too many to count. Half dozen names jump into my mind immediately on more recent listings. And so how do we evaluate restaurant stocks? The very first thing I think a US resident can do, if it's at all feasible, is take a personal assessment of the product of that business. Now, that does not for an investment thesis make, but, you know, like Peter Lynch in One Up on Wall Street advocated, I think there was a chain of motels, was it called?
I'm not sure.
La Coya or something like that. What?
It was last something.
Yeah. He dipped his toe in the pool and he lay on the bed. And, you know, taking an assessment of a restaurant chain that's floating or recently floated or about to float is, I think, a very good starting point.
Like us going for Beyond Burgers.
Exactly. You know, you can take a personal view. You got to buy what you believe in. Now, of course, we got to go deeper than that. And you, I suppose, need to then look at competition in that area of dining. If it's another burger joint or if it's something entirely different, like, you know, fast casual Asian street food. You know, there's a competitive landscape in the food type that you've got. But the real, I think, universally accepted metric to look at in dining, or rather restaurant stocks, is comps or comparable same store growth. I always get tongue-tied when I say that. So a restaurant can expand its revenues by opening more restaurants. But what comps does is it, and Ulta Salon, by the way, reported on comps, and I think it was up 6.something%. But comps looks at how has each individual restaurant performed relative to a comparable period 12 months ago.
Yeah.
Exactly. So comps is a way of looking at how a restaurant is doing. Is the food growing in popularity? Is that restaurant selling more of what it does? I think then you just have to do some benchmarking.
Yeah.
the opportunity for growth. So to see, I think when I bought Chipotle, it was only in a couple of states, and now I think it's all over the US.
International, yeah.
It's international, of course, absolutely. So we, you're kind of blending together the your assessment of the viability of total mass market adoption of this particular product, and then you couple it with the data available through comps and you know new openings.
Yeah. Importantly, on when you're talking about comps as well, there's two measurements within comps, which is the foot traffic that's going through the stores, and then the tickets, the average tickets. You can break down comps a little bit more, and that can show you, is there more people going to the restaurant? Is that what's driving up comps, or are they spending more per item to drive up comps? But in terms of restaurants, the restaurant sector itself has gone through what I would call a pretty turbulent couple of years. And I just did a little bit of research here and found these numbers. From 2001 to 2017, the number in the restaurants in the US grew from 460,000 to 620,000, a 34% increase. Meanwhile, the population in the US over the same time period only grew 14.5%.
Wow. Okay. Nice.
So what you're seeing in the restaurant business is just huge amounts of competition for not enough customers.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's probably been driven as well by the fact that there was a big shift to e-commerce, which left an awful lot of physical locations empty, a lot of stores closing down. And the one thing that you can't get online is going out to a restaurant. So you have this type of business that people physically have to go to. Obviously, not if you're getting takeout or whatever like that, but if you want to go to a restaurant, you have to physically go there. So, I mean, what they're dealing with at the moment, the industry, is they've also seen kind of increased food prices. There's a lot of pressure on wages, the $15 minimum wage and all that kind of stuff. So it's a very tough sector at the moment to be in. And I'd be cautious about which one you invest in. You really do need to find something with a differentiated product and a very good digital presence as well.
Okay, cool. So that was how to evaluate restaurant stocks. So let's move on to the elevator pitch before we finish up today. So this week I asked you guys to pick a company that's been a surprising success story for you. So a company that's performed well, but you didn't necessarily expect it to perform well. Rory, I'll come to you first. I'm going to give you 30 seconds.
Give me a minute. Come on. Okay. I've got to pitch a stock in 30 seconds.
All right,
okay,
go.
Yeah, God. So the stock, your intro there was a bit misleading because I did think this stock was going to do well.
Okay.
But I had no idea how well it was going to do. It really did shock me that how impressive it's been over the last couple of years. And the stock is Planet Fitness. So I think we added it to the showroom, evaluated it. It looked like a kind of nice discount gym product that would attract people who didn't want to spend an awful lot on the gym membership. But what actually I think they did there was they created a blue ocean opportunity by going absolutely against the tide in terms of what they were presenting to people, which was cheap, no-nonsense gym membership for people who wanted to go once or twice a week or once or twice a month. Last quarter, the revenue was up 29%. They added 400,000 new members. There's now more than 14 million members.
Wow.
They opened 59 new gyms this quarter, so nearly they're getting up to 1,900 new gyms. Same-store sales comps, which Hamish just mentioned, are up nearly 9%. And they had a Teen Summer Challenge program which allowed 15 to 18-year-olds to use their gym for free this summer, and they had 900,000 people join.
Wow.
So stock's up more than threefold since we added it. So that's the one that's really shocked me.
Kind of the opposite to Peloton.
Yeah, I wonder if this new connected fitness will have an impact on them. We'll have to see going forward.
Yeah, cool. Emmett, 1 minute, the company that surprised you.
I'm going to go with number 71 on the world's most valuable brands 2019 list as provided by Forbes. And that brand is Red Bull, which has a brand value of $9.9 billion. Red Bull has sold a cumulative 75 billion cans of its Red Bull soda since it was introduced in 1987, with a marketing strategy built on extreme events. And it's an energy drink that launched a whole new line of organic sodas in 2018. And of course, everyone knows this, and it is now a synonymous brand with extreme sports and giving you wings. And the reason it has surprised me is that has anyone actually tasted it? It's awful. Like, I mean, you know, it's back to that kind of Peter Lynch thing. I think that Red Bull is possibly the most vile thing I've ever tasted.
There was an interesting piece that I read somewhere, I can't remember where it was, but that it had to taste bad, Red Bull. Like, they made it taste bad on purpose, because anything that is supposed to have any sort of tonic effect on you, if it tastes good, you won't believe that it's having any sort of benefit.
Yeah, so it's like a medicine kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, it's that like, medicine flavour. Okay. And then also those thin cans, they're one of the first companies to have those thin, long cans. With the thinking being that if it was the same size as a can of Coke, people would refuse to pay three times the price. So you had to differentiate it somehow. So
genius. But it is really a masterstroke of marketing.
Oh, yeah. They're marketing geniuses.
They are marketing geniuses, yeah.
So that's about it from this week's Stock Club. Don't forget all the great new stuff in the My Wall Street app at the moment. And if there's anything you want us to discuss or explain on the next episode, please make sure to get in touch with us on Twitter. That's at My Wall Street HQ, or email us at pod@mywallstreet.com. Please don't forget to subscribe to Stock Club too. And if you're enjoying the podcast, leave us a review or a rating on whatever podcast platform you listen to us on. That's it from us here. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.